Hey folks, today's episode was sponsored by Datadog. It's a cloud-scale monitoring and analytics platform. Datadog was built to bring clarity to complex dynamic applications in the cloud, on-premises, in containers, or wherever they run. With beautiful dashboards, distributed tracing, and seamless integrations with more than 200 technologies, including Azure and Docker and PagerDuty, Datadog provides deep end-to-end visibility into the health and performance of modern apps. Visualize key metrics, set alerts to identify anomalies, and collaborate with your team to troubleshoot and fix issues fast. I'd like you to try it yourself by starting a free 14-day trial today. Listeners of this podcast will also get a free Datadog t-shirt. Get started at bit.ly.com/datadogshirt. That's bit.ly.com/datadogshirt. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Heather Terenzio. She's the co-founder and CEO of Tectonic Group. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Scott.
Tectonic Group has a great web presence that explains what you do, but I dug into the academy part of it. Can you explain the difference between the group and the academy?
Sure. About 5 years ago, we were having problems finding our own talent, and we decided we wanted to find talent in all different kinds of places and train them ourselves to write code the way that we thought was best. And what we did was we created Tectonic Academy. And what we do is we go out and we look for talent in all kinds of unexpected places, like baristas, busboys, you name it. We've actually had folks out of the foster care system, the jail system, and then all the way up to people who've graduated from college with mechanical engineering degrees. But now these are people who just are passionate and really want to get into software development. And so we bring them into our academy. It's actually really selective to get into. And through the academy, we train them in about a 12-week program. And after the program, they start pair programming with our software developers and eventually start working on real live projects. And actually, the way our model works now is that a client can hire us to write their software, and we'll do that with our real senior level development team, but we'll also be training up apprentices at the same time. And our clients can actually hire those apprentices as full-time employees after working with us for about 6 months.
Oh, interesting. I worked as a consultant for many years, and we always had a situation where the client would really enjoy working with someone, and then they try to hire them, and we discourage that. But in fact, you're doing the opposite.
Yeah, you know, it's been an interesting pivot for us in terms of our business model, because what we're finding is actually millennials change jobs about every 2 years anyway, and our clients are looking for talent. And so we figured we would find a way to kind of smooth that transition from working for us and getting them trained up on client projects and then working for our clients. So we've now become this company that writes software, but also creates a talent pipeline for our clients.
Mm-hmm. Not to put too fine a point on it, but you have an advanced degree. You went to Cornell. You have a civil engineering degree. You have an environmental engineering degree. But now you're talking about creating software engineers from, and again, no disrespect to hard work, from baristas. Where does, as someone with a formal engineering background, where do you fall on whether or not college is necessary to be an engineer?
Well, what's really interesting, and it's because of my background that, and I actually didn't learn how to code until I was on the job. And so, and everybody in technology has a story around the best software that developer that they ever met didn't necessarily have a college degree. If you've been in this industry long enough, you know some English major or self-taught coder who's been teaching themselves to code. And so as a part of my degree, I took some software development classes, but I didn't actually learn how to code until I was on the job. And it was that experience that gave me the aha idea that, you know, hey, this isn't stuff I learned in college. This is stuff I learned actually on the job. And there's probably a lot of people out there who can do the same without a college degree.
That's interesting. Now, but your degrees are in civil engineering and environmental engineering. Does that mean that someone could go and become one of those kinds of engineers, not a software engineer, but one of those without a degree?
I would say not necessarily, because there's a lot more that goes into it. And there's actually accreditations that have to happen to be a civil engineer. And I think that would be hard to get on your own. But with software development, it truly is a skill that can be learned. And, you know, with a foundation, a little ambition and desire, you can actually teach yourself how to be a software developer. Whereas, you know, there's a lot, obviously, there's a lot more at stake with civil engineering, right? You're building bridges and roads. And, you know, there's a long history of academics that come into being good civil engineers and mechanical engineers. But with software development, it's, you know, it's something that can be taught, and it's something you mostly learn on the job. And I think most college grads in computer science would tell you that they got a great foundation in college, but they didn't really learn how to do software engineering until they were on the job.
Yeah, we talk a lot about that foundation on the show here, and sometimes I use the term historical context about whether or not someone needs to understand the historical context of the internet in order to write good HTML or good JavaScript, and people seem to be split on the on that subject.
Well, I think there's always going to be different levels of engineers, and there's people who we need to write code, and then there's people who need to take a much, you know, the 50,000 foot view of what you're building and how the product's going to be built, and see the bigger picture. And so there's, you know, there's definitely a need for both, right? There's need for people who can write code and get the application to do exactly what you want it to do. And then there's people who have to look at the big picture and understand from a business standpoint, an engineering standpoint, an architectural standpoint, what this application is going to look like. And so both those people can work very closely together to build great software products.
That's a good point. I think that it's really easy to say, oh, I'm a coder or, oh, I'm a programmer, but there's intersectionality within programming. There's not just junior, senior, architect, et cetera, but there's testing, there's automation, there's build engineers, there's all kinds of flavors of engineer that one could be, and they don't all need formal education.
Absolutely.
So this is very exclusive. I understand that there was one time you had 400 folks show up for 5 spots.
Yeah, it is. Well, the great thing about what we do is we pay people on day one to be a member of our apprenticeship program, and that's because we're a Department of Labor approved apprenticeship program. It's part of the DOL regulations are that you pay people on day one. So think about your options in terms of choosing a boot camp or choosing us. At a boot camp, you'll have to take 6 months off of work and pay $20,000, sometimes $30,000. And with us, you're actually getting paid on day one. So it's become very competitive to get in. We've actually had to modify our entrance criteria and the work it takes to actually get in. But we really feel like we're producing an amazing software developer at the end of our program.
Can you talk a little bit about what that means to be in a Department of Labor approved apprenticeship program? Because you've mentioned that before in interviews, and I wonder, is that a hard thing? Is that more paperwork? What is that? Mm-hmm. What does that stamp of approval give you?
It's hard paperwork. It takes a lot of paperwork to get through it. But when we actually... Well, the story behind it is that we started calling ourselves an apprenticeship program fairly early on because that's what we were doing. We were bringing people in and we were training them side by side with more senior level folks, exactly like a plumber or an electrician might learn their trade. And we soon learned that it was an actual federal designation to be an apprenticeship program. And so kind of tongue in cheek, we thought we were being clever and we applied to become an official apprenticeship program. And it was a lot of paperwork, but actually no software development company had ever applied for this before. So it was actually written for plumbers and electricians, and we had to rewrite the entire documentation to accommodate a software development career. And we did all that. We worked very closely with the DOL. It took us about 18 months to get through the whole process. And we were the first DOL-approved software development apprenticeship program in the country. There's a couple... Today, there's a handful out there, and it's actually, I believe it's much easier today because we laid a lot of that groundwork early on.
How long is a registered apprentice program? I understand that a plumber might spend 32 months, you know, learning to be a plumber before they move on.
Yeah, ours is purely competency-based and skills-based, so it's not time-restricted. Mm-hmm. And with plumbers and electricians, I believe most of them are time-restricted, and it does take a certain amount of time that you have to put in. But with us, it's a minimum of 6 months, but it's actually taken people longer just to get all their competencies signed off on. So at a minimum 6 months, but sometimes a little bit longer.
And then there's usually a competency model or a way to go and determine someone's competency. How do you determine that someone is ready to be a junior engineer and move? Do they move from intern to, or rather apprentice to journeyman or journeyperson to junior engineer? What's the progress?
Yeah, we move from apprentice to a full-time junior engineer, and that's part of our process.
And does someone need to have a GED or high school? What's the spread of education that people come into this with?
Yeah, we've had folks with GEDs, and who just had been teaching themselves to code for years, and then we've had people with advanced degrees in other fields who now decide they want to get into software development. And I think actually we've been really successful in attracting women to these fields. I think a lot of women go into college and start out as English majors or philosophy, sociology, kind of the softer sciences, and then decide they want to get into a tech career but can't necessarily afford to start from the beginning again. But we give them an opportunity to cost effectively launch their careers in tech. And so our next class is over 50% women. And a lot of them have those kinds of backgrounds who, have a college degree, but in something else and now want to get into technology.
Yeah, it really resonated with me when you said that everyone has that story of that person with a non-tech degree who is the best programmer they ever met. The best one I ever met had a master's in music.
Yeah, actually, music majors are really great software developers. There's something with the mindset of a music major that makes you a really great software developer. And we've had actually several really talented musicians come into our program.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned also that you're pulling from kind of non-traditional places. You said millennials, but you also mentioned the foster care system. But I understand also that you have had convicted felons, which are folks who very often feel like construction or food service is all that they're able to find from a jobs perspective.
Yeah, I mean, companies are much more open to, overlooking people's backgrounds. But the story we have with a felon was that we were in our office one day and this young man walked in and said, "I read an article about Heather in Forbes when I was in jail, and I've been teaching myself to code for the past 10 years, and I'd love to work here." And we said, "Great, leave us a resume. We'll take a look at it." And he said, "I don't want to put my resume in a stack of resumes. I really want to work here." And so we asked him to volunteer for a couple weeks, for 2 weeks, to see what he had. And it turned out he was a very, very talented developer. And he'd spent a lot of time learning to code. And he made some mistakes early. He was a fairly young guy. He was only 20 years old. But when he was 18, he was selling drugs and, wasn't a bad guy. He wasn't violent. And he needed a second chance, and we gave that to him, and he's now a really successful software developer.
Does that seem like something that could be scalable? I wonder, with 400 folks for 5 spots, how do you scale something like this?
Well, our next class is actually 20 people, and we're working with some really large national companies to create a larger talent strategy for them. So kind of having them leverage our apprenticeship program to streamline people who are specifically trained in their technologies to go work for their companies. And so we'd see, we'd probably be in 3 different cities in the next couple of years. And, I could see us building out our Boulder, Denver presence quite a bit in the next few years as well.
I've heard interns at big companies, the Microsofts and the Googles and the Facebooks, say that they felt that the pace was too much and that the engineers that were working there, I didn't have time to sit with them and to really spend that time. How do you build that into something as competitive as software for hire?
Yeah, well, it's interesting in our field too, is when people like Microsoft or Google talk about an entry-level software developer, they're really talking about somebody with 3 to 5 years of experience. And you can't get 3 to 5 years of experience if nobody will take a junior-level person with less than that. So it's kind of this interesting catch-22, but that's really where we come in to bridge that gap. And we are taking people and giving them that initial entree into this field. I mean, if you think about somebody coming through a boot camp and you look on their resume and it says Starbucks, boot camp, and now I want a job, as opposed to somebody who comes from Starbucks, then apprenticeship program, then I was an employee at Tectonic, and now I'm looking for a job, that second person's going to be a lot more attractive because they have on-the-job experience and much higher percentage of getting placed at a great company. So it's that boot camp doesn't necessarily give you the launch you need. You really need that job experience, mm-hmm. and that's the stopgap that we provide.
How much context do you think people need in just using a computer? I've met, well, we were joking about something recently on Twitter. Jack Ryan is on Amazon right now, and he has a PhD in economics, and he made a comment about using SQL to do some queries. You know, and everyone's talking about that. And one of the people, someone from academia came in and said, well, he has a PhD in economics. Like, don't expect him to talk like a software engineer. And I thought that was a really interesting comment, because just because someone has an advanced degree in anything, engineering or otherwise, it doesn't mean that they're an expert computer user. Which brings me to the question I'm noticing as I teach my 10 and 12-year-olds that they get lost on the computer a lot. They can browse, but if they could lose a file, it might end up on C:temp instead mm-hmm. of their desktop, and then they go hunting for it. I could see the same things happening with someone starting out as an engineer, getting confused as they move around the machine itself.
Well, most of the people that come to us kind of already know they want to get into this career and have really started dabbling in you know, computers and building code and writing applications. And most of them have written something on their own, or at least gone on to Code Academy mm-hmm. and taken a few classes. But, you know, in this day and age, like, everybody should know what a SQL query is, right? Everybody should have some kind of foundation in what it takes to make a computer do what you want it to do. And, mm-hmm. you know, maybe instead of teaching Shakespeare going forward, you know, we should be teaching, you know, the basics of software development. And so that...
Yeah, absolutely.
Nothing against Shakespeare.
Yeah, of course. My 10-year-old recently took a class that was called Tech Skills for Middle School Success. And it was literally, you know, copying files from here to there, opening Word and doing those kind of things. I think a lot of stuff that people take for granted. A big thank you to our sponsors, because they make this show possible. And I hope that you support them the way they support us. Progress Software is the creator of the most comprehensive developer toolkit for building modern apps on the market today, Telerik DevCraft. With more than 1,100 Telerik.NET and Kendo UI JavaScript components and controls, you can easily build modern, high-performance web, mobile, and desktop apps, as well as chatbots. The toolset also includes reporting solutions, automated testing and productivity tools, and comes with a range of support options. New this year is a free online training program for all license holders. With this, alongside thousands of demos and source code available, comprehensive documentation, and a full assortment of Visual Studio templates, you'll be up and running with the Progress Telerik and Kendo UI controls in no time. Download a free 30-day trial today at telerik.com/Hanselman. That's TELERIK.com/Hanselman. So when people come into your program now, they are given that title apprentice and junior engineer. What kind of money can someone make? And if they started as a junior engineer, does it help or hinder their long-term earning potential?
Well, when you first come into our apprenticeship program, you'll make $15 an hour to start, and that actually mm-hmm. starts stepping up. And junior engineer is really depending on the level that you finish up at and the kinds of responsibility that you're taking on. I mean, you can make anywhere from $50,000 to $75,000 a year. And we've had people start all within those ranges. And then, you know, as it actually scales up very quickly from there. So within 3 years, you can be making $90,000 a year.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a really fast career path, and the unemployment rate in, at least in Colorado, is less than 2% for software developers. So you can really, you know, bounce around and look for higher and higher salaries, or you can look for more and more meaningful work, whatever's important to you. But yeah, the pay is definitely there. I mean, really what we're doing is we're providing a great pathway to a middle-class career without having to incur any of that college debt, if that's the route you're taking with us.
And I saw somewhere, if I remember correctly, that you had something like a 95% placement rate.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you make it, our selection process is really hard to get through. And then once you get through the class, and then you're on the floor with us for a while. So there's a lot of hoops to get through. And, you know, if you can make it through all that, you will be successful in this field. And really the people, the 5% who are not included, just decided to, you know, go back to school or stay at home with kids kind of things. But yeah, it's a great career path.
I understand that inclusion is a big part of this. Mm-hmm. You're bringing in women, you're bringing in people of color, veterans, at-risk youth. Everyone has a different communication style, and you're describing a very, very, intense onboarding process and vetting process. How do you make sure that you're not losing potential talent because you might be thinking culture fit and how people communicate? Everyone's different.
Actually something I write about quite a bit is that I can't stand the term culture fit.
I apologize.
I think too many companies have grabbed onto that. And it's become code for, we hire people who look like us, act like us, have the same background as us, and because that's our culture. And so what we have said is, we don't hire for cultural fit. What we hire for is skills, and we hire for people who can communicate effectively with us. And we actually like that people are all different kinds of backgrounds and all different kinds of cultures. And I'd say we write better software because of it, because when we come at a problem, we have six people sitting around the table who are coming at it from very different backgrounds and viewpoints, and ultimately, we're able to build better software because of it, because we have people who aren't all of the same, culture, right?
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. And I think people who are listening will appreciate that as well. I understand also that you received a grant from the Colorado Department of Labor to grow this forward. How do you get visibility at the government level on an apprenticeship program?
Well, because we're a DOL certified apprenticeship program, it actually qualifies us for grants. Most people think of grants going to only nonprofits, but apprenticeship programs also do qualify for grants. And there's not a ton of them. There's a few each year, but Colorado has been an amazing state to grow this program because they are very interested in this apprenticeship concept and creating talent and helping to solve the skills gap that we have here in Colorado. And so we work really closely with our local workforce centers, with CDLE, Colorado Department of Labor and Employment, to help grow this. And they've really been instrumental partners in this entire process for us.
And you've been appointed to a board by the governor to work on things like this.
I'm on the Colorado Workforce Development Board. And actually, I'm just getting started. I've only attended two meetings thus far, but it's actually been really interesting digging in from policy level into these workforce solutions because, if companies can't find the right talent, they can't grow. And, obviously in Colorado, the politicians are very interested in keeping us growing.
Yeah. Last year, about December-ish, the U.S. unemployment rate was about 4.1. But Colorado has almost 3% or a little bit less than 3%. So you've got a really low unemployment rate, but then you commented that there was a skills gap. So you've got low unemployment, but maybe you can't find the people with the skills you need.
Yeah, and that's why our program has been getting so much attention is because we're able to convert retail workers, baristas, into software developers. So even though the Colorado economy is doing amazing and lots of people are doing really well, there's a lot of people who are left behind. And they're in these minimum wage jobs and they can't afford to go to a boot camp and they can't afford to get into these kinds of careers. And what this has really done for those kinds of people is provided that bridge from barista to software developer or even English major into software developer.
Interesting. I'm curious why you use barista. Seems to be like a good go-to kind of archetype, though. But I think we all know that person that's on the way somewhere. If they haven't chosen barista as their final destination,
we've had amazing luck with baristas because they know the customer service side. They're good communicators, good multitaskers. We've also had amazing luck with folks from the Verizon store and the Apple store. Again, personable, outgoing, but like technology and are, kind of looking for the next step in their career.
Yeah. My wife and I were trying to teach the boys about that idea of that person that you meet behind the counter where you know they're going somewhere because they just have that spark of personality, whether it's the person that puts the guacamole on your food at Chipotle, you just go, this person's going to be running this place within a year. And those are the kind of people you want to hire.
Exactly. And like I said, we've had many, many of them come through and they've been very successful with us.
Why do you think that apprenticeships kind of fell out of vogue after the 80s and 90s? And why are we rediscovering them in almost 2020?
Well, you know, for better or worse, there's been this huge push for people to go to college. And I come from an immigrant family, and I was the first generation among my family to go to college. And there was really never any question that I wasn't going to go to college. And that was the road from, you know, my grandfather came from Italy as, you know, a Mason, and, you know, then his son went to community college, and then I was able to go to an Ivy League college. And that's kind of the immigrant American dream. And everybody has this mindset that college is the way, you know, to get into these white collar jobs. But, you know, now with everybody going to college and, you know, and incurring so much student debt, it really isn't making as much sense as it did in the past. And so I heard a statistic that it used to be that you could work through the summer and be able to afford a year of college. And today you'd need to work for an entire year full time in order to be able to afford a year of college. And so everybody incurring that kind of debt to be an English major or something that's not going to get them an immediate payback in terms of a career, it's not making as much sense as it did in the past. And so apprenticeships fell out of favor because, you know, the trades weren't a great pathway to a middle-class career, but at least in Colorado, there's a huge need for the trades and they pay really well. And with you can get into the trades without actually any college debt.
Would you think it's fair to say then that software engineering is now part of the trades? Would you put it up there with a skilled electrician?
I think it could be. It's something you can learn. It's something you don't need a full-on college degree to be really good at. And I don't see why not.
Yeah, it seems. Let me ask you this, though. We see people doing HTML and CSS. Could you bring someone in doing IoT or hardware or cloud development? Is it just about front-end web development, or is this software engineering of all flavors?
No, it's all flavors. I mean, it can be taught, right? You don't, and it, you know, in college, probably, you know, how much of those credits are within your actual major, and how much of that is all the stuff to make you a really well-rounded individual? And so if you kind of scrape away all the other stuff and unbundle the college experience so that you're just learning the pieces you need for your actual job, you know, you can be a great software developer. You might not be great at cocktail parties talking about, you know, other things, but you'll know software development. And, you know, I know most colleges pride themselves on not being trade schools, but you know, there is a need for this trade of software developer, and we need to kind of fast track people into these careers just to support the businesses that we have in the country.
Back, I've been in software now for 25 years, but 15 years ago, I went back to school to finish my degree. So the first 10 years of my software experience, I was not a degreed software engineer. And I went back for myself. I didn't go back because I necessarily felt pressure. I just felt like it was a thing that was not completed. But a number of people in underrepresented minorities expressed to me that there's a certain amount of privilege involved in being able to be 10, 15, 20 years into the business and not think about your degree anymore. While some folks still, even with a decade plus, get asked, what school did you go to? And as such, like you said, the immigrant dream is to go to like an Ivy League school or a top tier school as opposed to a state school. Do you think that interns or, pardon me, rather apprentices who have become engineers and then grown up to senior will have any kind of, for lack of a better word, prejudice against them saying, well, you came up in a non-traditional way, and then they would have to go back to school?
You know, I think in the past that may have been the case. I'm actually still surprised at how much my education comes up, and you know, it was 20 years ago or longer now. But you know, especially in software development, once you've proven your chops, people want you on board, and it really doesn't matter as much anymore. It really matters what you can do, and you know, even with our industry, credentials kind of come in and out of vogue because, you know, you can have all the credentials you need, but you could still not be a great software developer, right? So we just need people who can work well with within a team and write good code and think critically about what they're doing. And, you know, the school stuff doesn't matter as much. But I should actually mention, though, that as being a DOL apprenticeship program, when you get through our program, you qualify for 39 credits, college credits.
Oh, wow. So you could jumpstart your college career as an apprentice.
Exactly. I mean, we're accredited for 39 credits. It depends on whether that college will take all 39 of those. but it's a great start to a college degree and getting what you need. And we're actually really proud of that fact because, you know, we're recognized as an educational facility here because we're teaching, you know, all the basics of software development and learning it on the job. And we're glad that, you know, other colleges recognize that.
Now, no disrespect to boot camps, but there are some that are saying that kind of the shine is off of the enthusiasm around boot camps. And I was one of the biggest and remain a large fan of boot camps. But when boot camps became as expensive as Ivy League, you know, a year in an Ivy League school, $25,000, people were, you know, could abuse the system. Do you think that the apprenticeship program is superior to boot camps and the shine might be off boot camps?
I really do. I mean, I'm, you know, I built this program from the ground up. We built it out of a need to be more inclusive. I think boot camps, the face of the boot camp is still reflective of, you know, the typical tech employee, which is predominantly white male. But really, because we pay people on day one, it's really opened the doors to all different kinds of people. And actually, without even really trying, we are incredibly diverse as a company. We're 75% women, minorities, and veterans. And that's just because we've paved the way for somebody who might have a minimum wage job right now to actually get into this kind of a career. And it really shows that once you strip away that level of privilege, that all different kinds of people are really interested in getting involved in software.
Yeah, it really feels like if you cast a really wide net, you will pull in a representative group of people and you get kind of diversity and inclusion, I wouldn't say for free, but because of that wide net, you're getting what America looks like as opposed to a small slice of it.
Yes, exactly.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Yeah, thank you. This has been fun.
I'm going to put links to everything that the Tectonic Group is doing in the show notes, and you can be sure to connect with them and learn all about the great work that they're doing out there in Boulder. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
This has been another episode of Hanselman Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.